I was blessed to have very good parents. My father was born and raised a Catholic. His father was in the first generation from Ireland, and his mother had come directly from Ireland and married my grandfather, and they had married somewhat late in life, and so they just had the two children, my father and then his sister Agnes. And my mother was born and raised in a family of American Baptists, but at the time that she was courting my father was courting her, I should say, and then they decided to marry, she took instructions in the Catholic faith from Father Bernard McKevitt, who was the parish priest there in the home parish at Richland Center, Wisconsin. And she often said to throughout her life, he gave such a wonderful explanation of the faith that she simply came to realize that her Baptist faith was incomplete and that the Catholic faith completed it. And I remember as children, we were surprised to know that that she was a convert, because she was so fervent in her Catholic faith and insisted so much with us on knowing our faith and living it. At home, there was the connection with the parish, especially with Sunday Mass and with regular confession on Saturday, simply, I would say, was the high point of the life of our home. This was everything centered around Sunday Mass and then preparation for it with by regular confession on Saturday afternoon. Our parents so formed us in that central mystery of our faith, which is Christ's encounter with us in the sacraments, that remains today such a strong impression in me from my childhood. And then along with that, we had the Baltimore Catechism, which was a wonderful tool, and our parents were encouraging us to learn the Catechism, and then coupled with their efforts to teach us the faith, to answer our questions, we had a wonderful parish priest, Father Owen Mitchell. It seems like everything was coming from Ireland, but he also was a native of Ireland who had come to be a priest in the United States. He was a wonderful teacher of the faith. And then we had the Catholic school and the sisters in the Catholic school. Of course, they taught us all of the subjects, but they, in a particular way, there was a strong emphasis on the catechism. So I was also raised with a deep knowledge of the faith and with a sense that the faith is about so many wonderful mysteries that we must spend really a lifetime coming to know them more deeply, that we never know them completely. There was instilled in me a wonder at God's presence in my life, in the life of my family, and in the world. And finally, at home, there was a strong sense that one's way of thinking and speaking and acting could only be coherent with what we believe and with the presence of Christ in our lives from Sunday Mass. But this was also symbolized in our home by the enthronement of the image of the Sacred Heart of Jesus, also by a strong devotion to his Virgin Mother, the Blessed Virgin Mary. And my parents were they were loving parents, but they were very strict. And for instance, if we were to use inappropriate language or to act in a way that was not just and loving with others, they corrected us, and they showed us the importance of getting on the right track, to use your term, from the very beginning in order to be prepared for our whole lifetime. And I have to say, I'm now going to be 70 years old in June, and I think more and more, and this has been true for years, I think more and more of the lessons that I learned at home and how important they are. Now, I also was blessed to go to the minor seminary at the age of 14. My diocese, the Diocese of La Crosse, had a minor seminary. We had a wonderful group of priests who were in charge of the seminary, and they too continued in this same emphasis on the beautiful liturgy that we had in the seminary. The praying publicly of the rosary and the other formal prayers that we said, regular confession, and then a strong emphasis on the knowledge of our faith and to be able to respond to the many questions that people in the world have about the faith. And so that was also a tremendous a gift for me. What happened then in my life, I entered the seminary in 1962. I was born in 1948. But in the mid to late 60s, the great turmoil set in the church. And I remember also in the seminaries, which I attended in those years, there was tremendous turmoil. Many young men left the seminary. Some became very confused by the strange ideas that were going about, strange ideas with regard to both faith and morals. There was a tremendous turmoil, and people often say to me, well, why did you stay in the seminary when so many were leaving, or how did you remain with this very solid Catholic foundation when there were so many forces against it? And I think about it often enough, and I believe in a very particular way that it was thanks to my home, to my parents, and to those early educators, both the priests in my parish, the sisters who taught in the Catholic school. There also were some lay teachers in the later years, and then the seminary, the minor seminary, which was a most positive experience for me in terms of the life of faith, and I can't be thankful enough. I wanted to mention one other aspect of what kept me on track, which also has to do with the family, and that is that there were a number of other very good men in the seminary who became friends, and we very much encouraged one another to grow in the virtues that would be necessary for a priest, to grow in the virtues to be a good Christian. And in every case, those good friends that I had, I came to know their families, and I saw the same reality, namely good parents raising their children in a holy way with love, but also with a love that had substance. In other words, a love that made demands on us in order to be true love, and not simply some kind of sentiment, but rather a selfless and a pure way of relating to God and to one another. And so that's a somewhat brief account. I could write volumes on it. I might mention one other feature, which in my life is that when I was 7 years old, my father became very sick with a brain tumor, and he died when I was 8 years old. But even in that brief period of time that I knew him, the faith was the greatest gift which he gave to me. And I just relate one story, which I've told also in other places. When he was in the final stages of his illness and he was staying at home, the parish priest, Father Owen Mitchell, would come to our home to hear my father's confession and to bring him Holy Communion, and this happened regularly. This was in all the sadness of my father's illness, and we knew he was dying. We knew that, short of a miracle, he wouldn't get better. These visits of the priest were very happy moments and unforgettable. In those days, when the priest came to bring Holy Communion, of course, he came with a cassock and surplice. We met him at the door of the house with a lighted candle, a little procession into my father's bedroom where he was confined to bed. Then we would leave the room while the priest heard his confession. And then when the confession was over, we would return to assist as the priest gave him Holy Communion. But it will never leave my mind the importance of that arrival of Christ himself in our home at a very difficult time for my father especially, and how much this meant to my father, that this was really what sustained him until our Lord called him to himself. And so it always strikes me how if we remain true to our faith, and if we live our faith, especially in these critical moments, in a heartfelt way, God, even in those sufferings, brings so many blessings to us. And I often think that my father's illness had a great deal to do with my hearing God's call to the holy priesthood. And another point I would make here, and I think it's important to keep in mind, is that even though my father died when I was 8 years old, I've had a sense of his spiritual presence throughout my life. And what he had done in forming the home — I'm the youngest of six children — what he had done in forming our home together with my mother really, in an heroic way, continued. And so it was, and she always said, she never married again. She always said that was her whole life, the home that she had made with my father, and that she just couldn't think to marry again. But she continued in that same way, and above all, the importance of the Catholic faith and living the Catholic faith. I would say also one other thing, adding many things now, but I think it's important to note the role of siblings, of brothers and sisters also in this growth in the faith. And I think parents do, with each child, as they impart to that child a strong sense of prayer, of belief and good Christian conduct, that also is a gift to all the children. And I was the youngest, and so in a certain way I had these older brothers and sisters who were like little parents to me. And so I received a special measure, I would say, of Christian formation, because they were well-formed, and they, of course, expected me to think and act in a way, too, that was truly Catholic in the best sense of the word. And all of this, I have to say, has been most liberating. It's given me a great, great joy and a great freedom of living, the freedom which comes from having a discipline in one's life, of having developed strongly the gift of faith that God gives to us at baptism, and then living that faith. That is the most important gift that I've had, and it's that I wouldn't exchange for anything. I would say to parents, there is a great turmoil in the world, to be certain. We wouldn't have thought in the 1950s, for instance, when I was growing up, that the very inviolable dignity of human life would be under such attack as it is today, the horrible crime of abortion, but also now more and more euthanasia, as we've seen in some tragic instances that are public. But I know from my own pastoral experience, there's a lot of silent practice, hidden practice of euthanasia going on in society. Also, the whole calling into question of our human nature. As God created us, all we have to do is to read the book of Genesis. It's very clear that God made man, male and female, he made them. And he made man and woman to be joined together in a lifelong, faithful and procreative union by which he would continue to give new human life. All of these things are under attack today. Now, this so-called gender theory, and even parents that I know, that their children come home from school and are all confused. Little children announcing that they want to be a different sex than the sex that God gave them. So this can all be terribly intimidating, and many parents say to me, "Well, we don't, what can we do?" And I think the message I would give to you is this: we know who we are. We know how God made us. The church teaches, Christ teaches us in the church about our great dignity as man and woman, the distinction of the two sexes, the particular gifts given to each. and that the proper relationship between the sexes, such that there is no conjugal union, there is no marriage except between a man and a woman, and that that union is intended, and is, I shouldn't say is intended, it is a participation in the divine love, and therefore is faithful and is enduring, is for a lifetime. We just simply have to take the time to live this in our families and to try to purify our homes of any false messages with regard to who we are, what is human life, what is marriage, and what is its fruit, the family. But at the same time, to sit down with our children and to talk about these fundamental truths. And sometimes parents say, well, I'm not that well educated, or all these specialists, these teachers and others are telling, or what they might be seeing also on the internet, are telling the children something otherwise. But we can't be intimidated by that. We can't let that stop us from fulfilling our duty to talk to our children from the heart about who we are, what God intends for us, what is his plan for us and for our world. And children will hear that message much more powerfully than any other message. God has given a special grace to parents to communicate the truth to their children, and you should never doubt that. No matter that you don't have flowery language or some very eloquent way of expressing these truths to your children, if you simply tell them in your own language and with the love which you have for them as parents, this will have a lasting effect in their lives, be the great gift to them. And in addition to that, you're not alone in this fulfilling the tremendous responsibility of being parents. Our Lord is with you. It is our Lord who united you in marriage. As the Venerable Fulton Sheen said, it takes three to get married. In other words, it's the husband and wife and our Lord himself. And so his grace will inspire and strengthen you to carry out your duties. And in that regard, it's so important to center the life of the family upon Sunday, and particularly on the participation in Sunday Mass, and also as a family to regularly go to confession to meet our Lord in the sacrament of his forgiveness. These are tremendous fonts of grace. Then also to pray in the family. I would encourage you very much to consider enthroning the Sacred Heart of Jesus in your home as a devotion which expresses our Lord's constant presence with you. And then to pray the rosary. It would be wonderful if you could pray the rosary every day, if somehow with the seemingly impossible schedules that families deal with today in terms of activities of children and so forth, but to have some time each week when you pray the family rosary, and more often the better. And the other thing is to have particular devotions during the year. For instance, I remember at home during the month of May, we always made a May altar, a special table in our home with the statue of the Blessed Mother. And I lived in the country on a farm, and we would go out and gather wild flowers to bring in each day to have fresh flowers for Our Lady. All of those kind of things, first of all, are a wonderful expression of our own faith, but are a tremendous gift to children. But keep that in mind, too, that this, you're not bearing this burden by yourself. Our Lord is with you, and when you try to do the right thing, He will help you and assist you always with His grace, and ask our Blessed Mother and Saint Joseph to intercede for you and take your special petitions to them. Frequently enough, the question comes up in light of the massive immigration of Muslims in Europe, but it's also happening in the United States. What should be our attitude as Christians? And the answer is quite clear. Our faith teaches us that our Lord Jesus Christ is the King of the universe. He is the King of heaven and earth, that he alone is our salvation. He alone is the way, the truth, and the life, as he himself said. And so we have to live our Christian faith then more strongly than ever, so that these people of other faiths, especially of the Muslim faith, will see the truth that salvation comes through our Lord Jesus Christ alone. And God willing, by our good example and also by the help that we give them to understand the great gift of the Christian faith, that many will be converted. But our nations themselves, a nation like Ireland, true of Italy as well, the United States is a Christian nation, that Christian character must be maintained. They talk today about pluralism and that societies become pluralistic and that the church herself should adapt to this, that there are Muslims and Buddhists and so forth. And we respect, of course, each individual for what he believes. But at the same, that doesn't mean that we deny our identity as a Christian nation. And therefore, we need to do things. For instance, the discussion in Germany about the crucifixes in public places. Thank God that even some of the people, they're not Catholics, that we trust they're Christians, are insisting, no, it's important that in our public buildings there be the crucifix as a sign of the Christian character of our nation. And if we don't do that, then we risk losing our identity. In fact, we will lose our identity. And there's a particular feature regarding Islam, and that is that Islam as a religion is a form of government. In other words, the Islamic religion intends to also govern civilly the nation. And so we need to understand that Muslims, in accord with their own faith, as they grow in numbers in any nation, will then take over the governance of the nation, and then the Islamic religion will be enforced on everyone. And whereas our Christian faith gives character to our political leaders, but the church itself doesn't govern, but it seeks in every way to form good politicians, good leaders, so that the nation is led in a Christian way. This is a completely different approach, and in that respect too, it's very important to insist on Christian symbols in the nation, but more than that, to insist on the moral law, which is taught us in the Ten Commandments, which actually is taught to every man, because God makes every man with his law written upon their hearts, what we call the natural law. So this question of immigration is critical. It needs to be discussed openly. Now people are so afraid that they're going to be considered to be racist or in some way to be engaged in prejudice, but it's not a question of racism or prejudice to want to insist on the respect and the fostering of the Christian truths, which are at the foundation of the nation's origins and also are at the foundation of the common good which the nation should be serving.